The Bane Free Radio Hour.
So a theme I'm getting from your work, Chuck, is that people of very diverse backgrounds and motivated by disparate events that happen to them in those backgrounds can find a way to work together if they're sufficiently motivated and given enough good examples. Is this band of disparate people modeled on any groups you have come into contact with, Chuck, or is their ability to overcome their own prejudice in pursuit of a greater goal a kind of a hoped-for outcome of cross-cultural encounters?
I do have every hope for cross-cultural encounters, and I'm kind of a fan of that literature, which is not only found plenty in science fiction, but for instance, if you look at Forster's Passage to India, where you know the real driver of that book is can West meet and understand East and vice versa. It's really in Shogun. It's a first contact novel. I mean, yeah, okay, but it's a first contact novel. In the case of this, I would say groups. I think the potential is in any group, but I think the thing about what was the term you used? Provided with examples.
Yeah,
is that the term?
Good enough examples.
Good enough examples. I think that is true. Now we get into why do I write? Not why do I just write this? Why do I write? I think that if we are given enough examples, if we see something that is convincing about the value of integrity, the value of honesty, the value of basically saying there are things in this universe, I don't know of any yet, but they're actually more important than I am, to at least have that open mind. If you have enough people like that in a group and enough other people who are tilting in that direction, if the cards fall right, it's remarkable what they can get done, and be stronger for it. Because one of the things about when you have all that cooperation from a very homogenous group is you lack the diversity of perspective, which is actually a wonderful place to find more answers and more options than you would normally have if you're all we all came from the same background, we all read the same books growing up, we all lived in the same kinds of communities. You come up with the same kinds of answers. And as a matter of fact, you probably don't have much of an instinct for seeing the different as positive. It's so easy to other when there's such a strong definition of what is right. And so I guess you could say it's not just that I think it's possible in diverse groups. I think that if you're able to find enough people from wherever they come that have that those examples, it's actually richer that way, which is the reason I thought of E.M. Forster, because you have the reason the contacts happen is not because they actually have some intellectual breakthroughs or spiritual breakthroughs. It's because you have enough people who are trying to do the right thing. And somehow we muddle through.
So with your military and business background, Chris, is this something you've observed firsthand in these arenas, or?
I don't know if you and the audience are familiar with the movie 12 O'Clock High, but, you know, certainly a World War II movie. They're flying, you know, B-17s. You know, the one main character, you know, the CO hates him, puts him in the leper colony, the bomber called leper colony. He puts him into the plane, and he uses that plane to dump all of the people that he doesn't like. And they call themselves the leper colony, and the leader actually uses it to bring the group together, and everyone works their hardest to show that we're better than all of you. And I had a similar thing happen while I was in the military. After I got out of A6s, they went away for budget. I was in a big land-based reconnaissance plane that had about 20 people in it. And I had somewhat of a falling out with my commanding officer. He thought the squadron existed, you know, as his toy, and I disagreed. You know, we'd get back from somewhere, and he'd have everybody in working the next day. you know, for no reason. So he put me on the leader of this one crew, and then he used it as the place to dump everybody else that he didn't like. And having seen the movie, you know, I used some of the similar things and, you know, brought the group together, and we did so well versus everybody else that, when it came time for the Kosovo war, he had to fly our crew the opening night because he knew we were the best. And then because that's the way he was, he came and flew with us, and didn't say a single word to me the entire flight. But, you know, that was pretty much vindication. And, you know, it's a lot of the principles are things that, you know, you see Bowden doing in the book. To we're going to show them, you know, we're going to do this because it's the right thing to do. And we're better. We're better than all of them.
One of the things I really enjoyed was the, give me an inch and I'll make it happen. One of the things that Bowden does is he gets the one family to agree to something. And then it was like, okay, I'm going to parlay that into the next family. And now everybody else is on the outside. I'm not.
Oh, really? Joe already said that he's in.
Exactly.
What do you mean? Yeah. Oh, you're not going to be in, even though Joe's in? Oh, well, all right. Sucks
to be. You may not like Joe, but Joe's going to get all the glory.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was quite well done. I really enjoyed this book, so I'm excited to see what else is on the horizon. Chuck, I think I've talked about this from the other end. We were talking about Into the Vortex and its sequel, but I noted a word I've only read in Kane Riordan books: reification. Is this a sign that there's a connection between your science fiction universe of this and that of the This Broken World?
I don't think reification is used in any particularly revealing manner, though. It's just used as a word, isn't it? By, I think, Vat, talking about getting information and getting clarity on information, I think, right? Do I recall that correctly, or am I misrecalling it?
I thought reification was in here, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, it's in the book. I know it's in the book. By the way, I didn't hear you there for a minute.
Yeah, I was muted because I've got lawnmowers and stuff in the back.
Oh, no, reification is in the book, but I don't think as a capitalized word.
No.
And so it's a word with uses. That said, it's a word that's often on my mind. So I'm going to say to listeners and readers of this and other things, make of that what you will.
So, Chris, given your background, I assume you choreographed some of the space combat. Did you use?
Yes, I did. I think all of the space combat.
And did you use historic examples, or as a jumping off point, or just create from whole cloth?
Just created from whole cloth. You know, what are the Kulcians going to do? How is this going to work? You know, they're coming in with one mindset. You know, how do we attack this? You know, I looked at it as I would from, you know, a bombing mission. Okay, we need to get to that one guy. You know, they had to take out the big ship first. How do we do that? Okay, then once we do that, what do we do for the next one and the next one and the next one? And just tried to game plan, you know, okay, what are the what ifs? You know, how do we use the technology that we have? Our technology is pretty crappy based on, you know, even what I had back when I was flying, you know, my F-18 off of the aircraft carrier for command and control, you know, and that's really the one thing that they had a little bit more of because of the Dornanis that they could use. And, you know, can we make that make a difference? You know, so how do we use the things that we have that they don't to get an advantage, because there's a whole lot more of them.
Well, and they're also not, the lost soldiers don't train sharks. They train wolf packs.
Yeah. Right?
You know, that's the thing about the Kulcians, is that they seem to be pretty much just a bunch of sharks.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, and in that you have Kevin Bowden's great triumph, which is that he taught would-be sharks to think and act like wolves. And right. Guess what? When you do, you become them.
Mm-hmm.
So he's part of that major cultural change. The one thing that I think from the space side that I generated everything, I think, before we got down to the tactical, how they got right. there, the yeah. you know, the all of that sort of stuff. But I wanted to be hands off, and I didn't need to be there. We had, you know, we had a person who wanted to be an astronaut plus as a fighter pilot. I mean, no, I didn't need to do any of that. The only thing I needed to do was I knew some things about, and this was like one of those Eric Flint things. We did a little, we fiddled a bit with whether something was a railgun task or a laser task. And that had to do, but that had to do with energy and time when you get right down to it. But quite frankly, if you take a look at the small number of things that actually had to be changed for that, I felt it was pretty light.
That was Chuck going, okay, you're not being faithful to hard sci-fi. You need to tighten it up there a little bit there, mister.
Well, it was neat too. It was neat as a reader, because going through it as a reader, they're going to have to reiterate and try and figure out what works best. And you want to change things. It added tension for me that you want to change things at the very last moment. You're going to change your primary weapon system or your anti-missile system. So yeah, you're like, oh, these guys are not going to make it.
And I will say, you know, when I started writing the space portions of it, I went back to the early NASA flights and read all of the different mission transcripts and, you know, how things worked, and, you know, to try and get the, okay, you know, if you speed up, that, you know, this is actually what happens. You can't see somebody in front of you and just hit the gun, you know, just try and gun it to catch up, because then you go up and you go, you know.
If you're near a gravity well, the rising factor will occur.
Yeah, you do all sorts of, you don't look like, you know, you want to go there, but to go there, you've got to go, you know.
Yep. And the closer to the planet you get, the more profound that effect. Mm-hmm.
You get down in the air, and then I know all that. I can dogfight with the best of you.
Yeah. That was actually a lot of fun, and we could have written it. I could have come in and said, well, let's just make a universal change. But I think Chris and I both saw the opportunity in what you were talking about,
yeah.
Chris, that it's like, well, you know, these things don't happen right the first time, and it's good for drama. Because you're not true.
Yank it all out.
Yeah. Yep. And it was, and for me, it was also the fact that, and this is what you can't expect, you know, I have a hard time keeping track of all the stuff that I've established in the Kane Riordan series right. at this point. Yep. But I also knew there were previous limitations, because small craft, relatively small ship combat had been portrayed in pretty significant detail in both the third and the fourth books. Because you've got that corvette fighting against a hunter patrol craft, and it's similar. It's that similar scale. So it got into the nitty gritty and a little bit of the weeds in terms of what sort of energy densities are there. You know, and depending on that, what the technology of a laser is, what you can ask it to do. So that was also it wasn't just hard SF. It was hard SF particular to the series right. that grew up out of. Really kind of geeky hard SF. Yeah. So,
okay. No hand wavium there, Kennedy. Yeah. How's this going to work?
That is not.
No. It was all fair. And remaining true to the series was important. And, you know, I say that jokingly about the, you know, okay, Kennedy, but you know, it was important to do that and to make it work so that it, you know, it doesn't break the universe. I mean, you know, you want to, when you go and play in somebody else's sandbox, you don't want to go and take a dump there. You want to, you know, you want to play nicely with the toys and, you know, leave it at least as well as you found it.
Yeah. And I think it was, I think the, just to give you an example of how much it is not a case of Chris Kennedy Handwavium. All the things I did not have to edit that I normally have to edit if something is going on. That spaceships bank in space. No. that you don't, you know, it's like, well, we got to stop now. Well, all of that acceleration you put in, you're going to have to throw an equal amount of energy out to get that to cancel out. And I hope you haven't distorted yourself by passing near any gravity wells while you've done that. And also didn't have to say to Chris, in space, the only way you can see a laser is if you're looking down the barrel, because there's no plasma or atmosphere to create side scatter, which is actually what makes it visible. Right. And we can see that ourselves too, just on planet. You'd kind of think you take out your laser pointer and pass it through the fog. Wow. You can see exactly where that bugger is going. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you can generally only see the dot, you know, and all of these.
You don't want to be the dot.
No. That's the eyeball. It's like, oh, I can see the, you know, it's pretty much the last thing that goes through your head before the laser itself. But a joy working with Chris, because I don't have to have my Canon protection hard SF nerd hat on to make sure that it's all going to go through. And that's a big relief and a joy.
It was a lot of fun to write with them, with Chuck too. I mean, you know, it was, I've really enjoyed being in this series. You know, I've got three, you know, two short stories ish and then, you know, half of this, and it's been a ball.
So it's been a ball to read it too. So you guys did a great job. Penultimate question here. What, aside from its raw entertainment value, do you hope readers will carry with them long after reading Admiral and Commander? Don't answer all at once.
Well, I'm gonna say teamwork. Teamwork and self-sacrifice, which are themes in a lot of the books I write. You know, anytime you're in the military, you know, it's about teamwork and self-sacrifice. You know, the whole Band of Brothers things where, you know, you're fighting not for somebody back home, you know, usually you're fighting for the guy alongside you, and you do anything you could for them. And that's, you know, pretty much what, I hope people take out of it.
Yeah. Sure. And talking about Band of Brothers, the two things that were, when I spoke to Chris about it the first time, I want to say that was 2017.
Long time ago.
Yeah. And I said the concept was essentially Band of Brothers meets Kelly's Heroes.
Yep.
And I think actually it shows those bones. I think it ultimately, though, Kelly's Heroes has the, it's more, I think, Band of Brothers, and quite frankly, I'll go with that. Kelly's Heroes is great, but Kelly's Heroes is only 2 hours long, if that. Right. And you can sort of laugh at it, and you can laugh at the spectacle of war as a basis for comedy. But when you took a look then at the backstories that everybody came up with, I was pretty sure we weren't going down the comedic route primarily.
Yeah. We were,
you know, and so it had to evolve more in that direction. But the reason I'm saying all these things is because I think what Band of Brothers has, and even Kelly's Heroes in a weird, dark way, if anybody was to take anything away from this, it is the power of hope and the necessity of hope. Because this book is about, as most of the Kelly's Heroes, the Lost Soldiers events, if you can't win if you don't play.
Mm-hmm.
And they come, and when they get on the field, they give it their all. And I think that would be, if I could say, if there's a life lesson I would say that has been meaningful to me, and if I could pass that on through my fiction, hope more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent answers. So what conventions can your fans hope to catch up with you at, and what other work do you have in the pipeline for your fans to read? Chris, you want to start us?
I'll be at LibertyCon. And then I think the only other one that I have left this year is 20 Books Vegas, which is now Author Nation. But that's in Las Vegas in November, which this year actually has a bigger fan component. So fans can come and do a lot more. There'll be a lot more fan-based activities, as well as the book fair, where they can come and talk with the authors. There'll be panels. There'll be a number of other things. So that should be a lot of fun. If you're going to be in Vegas in November, you know, add that in, because it's going to be really neat.
So just a question. You were going to be at Superstars this year. So are you going to try to add that in next year?
He said this year.
This year. Okay.
Just in the near future. Next
yeah,
year
too. That's, you know, that's next February. Yes, I do intend to be at Superstars next February. Would have been there this year, but my wife had a total knee replacement on February 1st, which kind of, yeah. And then she broke both her ankles as soon as she got better. So,
and are you going to Fantasy?
I'm going to Fantasy, but this is apparently going to air after Fantasy. So,
right.
Hey, if you were at Fantasy, you'll see me there.
Coming time to you there. From the future in the past.
Yes.
Or maybe. Might go up this Friday. Who knows?
Okay. If it goes up this Friday, then I will see you at Fantasy this weekend.
And you, Chuck?
Right now I'm waiting to find out on a surgical date for a son, and there are a whole bunch of reasons why I'm not sure about that. So if that is not the date that it's currently slated for, then I will probably be at Balticon in Memorial Day weekend. After that, LibertyCon in June. After that, DragonCon. After that, Capclave in the DC area. And after that, I think my last appearance of the year is at TravelerCon. If you are a fan of classic travel or any form of traveler, you really want to go to TravelerCon. Let me tell you.
Where is that, Chuck?
That is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So not the easiest to get to, but not that hard either. And
did you know that's where I was an elementary school principal?
No.
I was an elementary school principal in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Holy gosh. Okay. Well, so if you know any traveler folks, tell them, because it is a really good time. And it's not just a good, even if you don't know traveler, I'm going to say it's a really good con to go to, because if you know much about traveler, you know that is probably where a lot of my instinct for hard SF-ish rigor comes in. I just went further. But the folks there, everyone who's there, that's their MO. That's their wheelhouse. So if you like hard SF or just SF that isn't Star Wars, I think you'll be able to go there and have a great time. So that's where I'll be.
And as far as books, Chris, you want to give us your next coming?
Let's see. I'm in addition to Admiral and Commander, I have two series that are coming out right now. The Ashes of Entesia series with Casey Azell, another fine Bane author. And then I'm also working on
CKP author.
And CKP author. Yay, CKP.
And contributed to this series.
And yeah, absolutely. doing the Symbiote Wars with J.N. Chaney, which is coming out. The third book drops here probably a week after this goes live. If you haven't read Symbiote Wars or Uplink Squadron, check them out.
Cool. Chuck?
So with this just recently out, actually there was a book that should have been out just before this, which would have been the third edition, a much expanded edition of the first book in the Kane Riordan series, Fire with Fire. However, because of things, you can get it in ebook format, but the physical books are still, they went missing, if you can believe that, from Ingram or wherever they were all sort of being gathered together. And we're told any day now. Great. So, but however, it's out there. I think for fans of the series, they have lots of pretty pictures in them that were actually commissioned straight for the series. Cool. Designs of, for instance, what does the what do the shift carriers look like? What is the there's a ship that shows up. It's kind of, I guess, my series equivalent of the Rocinante in Expanse is the Puller, the Corvette that has shown up multiple times and will continue to do so. And so whenever that arrives, that arrives. After that, other releases this year are, I think, just smaller versions of books that have already come out. They're the mass market paperbacks, because last year, as folks will know, I put out three books with Bain last year, all solo. No, excuse me, I'm wrong about that. This one was written last year with Chris, and then there were two books in the Kane series, and those are the first new books in the Kane, the Direct Arc, books 6 and 7, the two first two books of the Species arc, released within 3 or 4 months of each other. And the audiobooks will eventually show up, I am told, but that's been unfortunate too. So the things that I'm working on right now are two books with a real unknown, but has a lot of promise in the field. You might have heard of him, David Weber. So he has...
that guy gets around. My book with him just came out, you know, last month.
Yeah, so he actually, and this goes back to something like 2016, he was going to do a collab with me in the Kane Riordan universe. He's been an early reader, early adapter, early, very, very positive testimonial writer. And Eric was going to do another, and they were going to be in sequential. They were respectively Misbegotten and Triage. Triage was going to be Eric's book. And so what David did, without anybody asking, he just jumped in and said, I'll do that one too. So we are probably doing them one right after the other. If not, I am in the process of launching a very different Patreon experience. It is, and I am really excited to put that out there, because I am sick and tired of depending on mailing lists and Facebook for staying in touch with fans and readers and vice versa. And I think that the time has come that I want to make sure that no matter what the crazy the future of publishing is, that I still know where to find them and they still know where to find me. So I don't write that second book with David Weber this year. Then it'll probably be the third book in the Vortex of World series, which is, if the first two, you can once again sense a pattern, this broken world into the vortex and toward the mall. So that is the third book in a Bane trilogy. So almost certainly it is not the last book.
Well, very cool. So this has been Griffin Barber in conversation with Charles E. Gannon and Chris Kennedy, authors of Admiral and Commander, forthcoming from Bane Books. Thank you for being with us today, Chuck and Chris.
And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynn Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the Elven Court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
The cold water scrub was bracing. She'd rather never do that again. The tub's water seemed hot enough to melt her into a careless puddle, but she found herself worrying about everything. Why did the queen want to see her? Was Winwolf in some type of trouble for using the Skin Clan magic? How was she going to stand being so short and plain in a herd of high-caste elves? And why did Sparrow have a Dao mark? Had the female been human in some distant past? Pony tapped on the door. Domi, pardon, but Sparrow does need you to fit your clothes. It took every ounce of courage to climb out of the tub, tie on the bathrobe, and unlatch the door. Pony looked as unhappy as she felt. What's wrong? She asked him, trying not to clench the bathrobe tight around her. It covered her neck to ankles, and then some, but still she felt naked in front of him. There is much for you to know before you meet the queen. What is proper and what would be unspeakably rude. It is not my place to tell you these things, for I am just Sakasha. But there is only Sparrow, and I'm afraid she's taking a Kate. A Kate? She giggled. It was a purposely rude way of saying Sparrow was throwing a snit. Why? I suspect she's jealous of you. Of me? She had ambitions to become Windwolf's wife. Seeing the look on her face, Pony added quickly, No, they are not old lovers. There are some who make alliances with marriages, where two work together well, and they agree to make it a partnership. But that would not suit Windwolf.
Are you sure?
I have known Windwolf all my life, and I believe I see him with clarity, whereas Sparrow, age only makes you wiser if you stay honest with yourself.
Why does she have a Dao?
Windwolf's father marked her when she was young to raise her out of the Q-Town caste. Otherwise the Sakasha would have never listened to her orders.
Ah, yes, the snobbery of elves. Like it or not, she was stuck dealing with it now. What does the queen want with me anyhow?
She wishes to see you.
Me? Why? I'm just a snot-nosed Pittsburgh teenager with an interesting ear job. Pony nodded several times, as if ticking off her words in an effort to parse them.
Yes, he finally said, still nodding. Exactly.
What?
You are a young elf. All things elfin fall under the queen's power. Now that you are elfin, you are now her subject.
Automatically? I don't get any say?
No more than when you were born in Pittsburgh and fell under Maynard's power.
She wanted to say that was different, but she couldn't decide how. The fact that her conception was far from normal, perhaps paralleling her transformation into an elf, gave her a very unstable base to argue from. Does she do this with every elf?
No. You are, however, now her cousin.
What?
You are now her cousin,
Pony repeated, more slowly. How did that happen?
You married Windwolf.
He's her cousin?
Yes, which by law makes you her cousin too.
It was such a sane reason that Tinker found it comforting.
Please. Pony indicated that she was to head back to the observation room. Sparrow has a gown ready for you.
Tinker winced. Oh, I don't like the sound of that.
Why not?
In my own clothes, I'm still me. I can't see the change, so I don't notice it.
I am sorry, but it will be better if you look your best.
Fortunately, in a manner of speaking, only Sparrow was in the observation lounge. The other females had been banished to another part of the ship, most likely because of the limited space in the room. Pony took up a post by the door and practiced at being invisible. We only have a few hours before arriving at Almranau, Sparrow told her. We'll be going straight from the airfield to an audience with the Queen. You must be ready. She handed Tinker a mass of fabrics. This is a court gown. Tinker fumbled with it for several minutes trying to make sense of it, until Pony finally took pity on her and reorganized the layers. He held it out then, by the shoulders, for her to see. It was a deep, rich, mottled bronze that looked lovely against her dusky skin, a silk soft as rose petals. While the skirt flared out full, the bodice seemed to be skin tight, with long sleeves that ended in a fingerless glove arrangement. It wasn't something she'd pick out for herself. To start, there was no way to roll up the sleeves to keep them out of grease. Tinker wasn't even sure how you would get it on. She supposed you pulled it over your head and wriggled a lot. Over the bronze silk was another layer of fine, nearly invisible fabric with a green leaf design, so that when the bronze silk moved, it seemed like sunlight shimmering through forest leaves. Sparrow waved toward a folding screen set up in the corner. Step behind there and put it on.
Just pull it over my head? There are small hooks here that will close after you slip it on. Sparrow flipped the material up to show tiny hooks and eyes, oddly enough made of cling vine and ironwood instead of metal. Pull and wriggle. She tried not to think of Pony standing on the other side of the mostly fabric wall as she gyrated half-naked. Wolf who rules sent footwear. Sparrow fastened the tiny hooks in the back of the dress. It fit nearly as snugly as Sparrow's gown. The female elf clucked and pinched it tighter. It needs to be taken in more. Sparrow handed slippers that matched the gown. Tiny, dainty things that Tinker loathed on first sight. But sitting on the floor were two pairs of stylish boots, heavy enough to please her. She tried one of the slippers on, hoping that they'd be too small, and found they fit perfectly. How do you know my size? Windwolf had your clothes measured, Pony said. Tinker marveled at the slipper. Truly? The high heels I was wearing were too wide. Sparrow sniffed. He asked me to measure your clothes, but I knew how humans make their clothes. Standard sizes that fit no one well. I measured you while you were sleeping. How utterly creepy. So why is the queen here? Tinker asked Sparrow to avoid thinking about it. I don't know. Sparrow smoothed away a hard, resentful look. We no sooner arrived than the queen requested that you be sent for, and that triggered an argument over you. Me? You? Windwolf wanted to keep you in Pittsburgh until you adjusted, but Soulful Ember insisted that you be fetched, which resulted in my being sent back. I had to leave before learning why the queen has come to the Western Lands.
Considering the speed at which the court moves, Pony said, you may not have missed more than the formal greetings and exchange of gifts.
Sparrow fidgeted. No, something has happened. I've never seen the court like this. The queen has her full guard with her and two dreadnoughts.
She glanced sharply at Pony, as if she had said more than she intended. She picked up another gown.
Change into this one and give me that gown to have altered.
It was more difficult to wriggle out of the tight bronze silk than it had been putting it on. She handed it out to Sparrow and slipped the next one on. While she disliked the notion of her wearing a dress, she had to admit that the gown was a lovely mottled green. She came out from behind the screen, smoothing down the skirt, to find Sparrow gone.
What are dreadnoughts?
Tinker asked Pony, glad she didn't have to look ignorant in front of Sparrow.
Gunships, Pony told her. Very big gunships.
Here, hook me up and back.
He hesitated a moment before crossing the room to fasten the little hooks. She found herself blushing as his fingers brushed her bare skin. In the full-length mirror, she could see their reflection, him leaning over her, the muscles of his arms rippling under his tattoos. She looked away, for some reason embarrassed by the intimacy shown. She hunted for a safe subject to talk about.
The wyvern female triggered her spell tattoo for some type of shielding. Do yours trigger defensive spells, too?
Yes. The shield is to protect you from damage you can't avoid. They are a last resort, but they cannot be taken away from us, short of removing the skin from our arms.
The wyverns are red.
Red is the Fire Clan's color.
The queen is part of the Fire Clan?
She is head of the Fire Clan.
And Windwolf is Wind Clan? Getting a nod, she asked, does that make me Wind Clan too?
Obviously, this was a why is the sky blue question. Someone could tell her a reasonable answer, but it stumped Pony.
You were human, and humans don't have clans, so there was no other choice but for you to join the Wind Clan.
She looked down at her spill of mottled green silk and the tips of her bronze slippers peeking out from the edge of the skirt.
Why am I not wearing blue?
Pony indicated her Tao by touching his own forehead.
That speaks of your alliance, but it is not necessary for Damana to announce their clan. Only the lesser castes do.
Tinker frowned, recalling all of the blue Sparrow was wearing, from the cerulean overdress to the ribbons woven in her hair.
Why is Sparrow in blue, then?
Pony clicked his tongue in an elfin shrug.
Sparrow has issues of her own making.
They reached Om Ranau just before sunset, and the palace sprawled glorious in the shafts of deep gold sunlight. It crowned the steep hills along the river, white limestone with mullioned glass windows,
partially obscured by towering trees and a riot of flowers. "Om Renau," Pony murmured beside Tinker as the gossamer closed on the palace. "As Viceroy, Windwolf usually stays here? Does the palace come with the appointment?" Pony nodded to the first question and then shook his head. "It is his, not the crown's." "Your boyfriend is rich," Tinker thought, and then winced as she remembered that, as far as the elves were concerned, Windwolf was her husband. "We're going to have a long talk about that." Typical of elfin design, the palace seemed to be a linked series of buildings incorporating the natural landscape. Beyond the structures that crowned the hill, more buildings stepped down the eastern exposure, tucked onto ledges and around a steep waterfall. In one wide flat area, jarring against the green and white, sat a courtyard filled with tall, stark black stones. "What are the stones?" Tinker asked, pointing them out.
"Nothing for you."
Sparrow focused on storm clouds moving toward them. She made a slight hurt noise and headed toward the control cabin.
"They are the WindClan's spellstones,"
Pony told Tinker, glancing after Sparrow, and then he too focused on the storm clouds. The dark forms converged in a manner not natural to clouds, although far too large and dark to be other gossamers. "What are those?"
"Dreadnoughts," Pony said.
As the airships drew closer together, she saw that they were a product of elves' contact with man. Instead of a living ship like the Gossamer, the dreadnoughts were fully mechanical, obviously a blend of airship and armored helicopter. The barrels of heavy guns bristled from the black hull, reminding Tinker of the spiked hide of a river shark. The two dreadnoughts blocked the airspace over the palace and flashed out a warning on a signal lamp. A few minutes later, having apparently received some communication back from the Gossamer, the dreadnoughts pivoted and moved off.
"How odd," Pony murmured,
his eyes narrowed in speculation.
"I've never heard of the flagship being challenged before. Sparrow is right. Something has happened."
That was another installment in Wynn Spencer's Tinker, and that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week in the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.